for inviting me to present today. I'd like to welcome everybody too, actually, on behalf of the Yugambeh peoples, of which our subgroup, the Kombamari mob, is about six or seven other groups, stretching from about the Logan River down to the Tweed River and out into the foothills, out to the range. It's called, actually, the Land of the Five Rivers, if anybody didn't know that. It's five rivers in our place, in our land. So welcome. I hope everybody gets interesting things out of this and enjoys it. And
just adjust this one.
There
we go.
Thank you.
No worries, is that?
Yep. Thank you. And I always like to put the map up, because although it's created and invented by a white fellow, Tyndale, and there are some things wrong with it, and there are different versions of it, but it's the principle of the thing, because it's so important. It's central, really, in a way, to an Aboriginal worldview, our ideas and our place in this old country. And I was just going back, take into account what you just talked about then, about substantive and procedural rights, is it? Yeah. And I can't remember the name, but there is Aboriginal words for the internal collectives, clan groups' governance of their country. So they have Aboriginal, there's an owner, an Aboriginal style owner, of the land, and then there's a kind of like a manager. And they both have rights, obligations, and change, and looking after the land, being custodians and so on. Whatever change has to happen can't be accomplished without the agreement of both. It's actually called a particular style of governance. I can't think of the word now. But whatever has to happen, one guy, or woman, has to say something, and it has to have the agreement of the other person. And to me, it rings a bell to do with procedural and substantive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's how, in a small society like Aboriginal clan groups, how they work that out. So it's away from rights as such, of course. There's not an idea about rights in our Aboriginal ideas about responsibility to land. It's more to do with obligations. And I've always been curious, and I think Michelle has explained it, or tried to explain it, and other people have tried to explain it in law. I could never understand, even our own rights-based activists, always going for rights. And why isn't obligation seen as strong as rights? Do you know what I mean? Why can't our arguments be made on the basis of obligations as strong as rights? And I've thought about it over a long period of time, spoken with many other, of course, Aboriginal people, considering these same difficulties, and the brilliant Professor Irene Watson. I've learned so much from her about law, about Western law and about Aboriginal law, actually. But over all this time, and I've spoken to her about what I'm trying to work out, the ideas, the underlying ideas about Aboriginal thinking, the underpinnings, of our philosophy and so on. And thinking about this relationship with the land, first of all, without going into the whole thing about migrations out of other countries and here, you know that Aboriginal people, old Aboriginal people, have always said this is the country in which we became human. Mm-hmm. So the reflective human self realised itself, developed or evolved, whatever you like to say, in this country. So there's no race memory of monkey dreaming, or the idea about a long trek or a long boat, in over water or anything like that. We became human in this country. We're human in this country. So the first relationship is with land itself. And the equation goes something like that. Land has invented us. We look after it because we're obliged. So obligation comes first. So it goes on like that, a reciprocal system. It looks after us, we look after it, it looks after us, we look after it, so on and so on. And after a while, you've got a philosophy, basically, after several thousand years. So we're always obliged. It's the development of life principles of a particular collective, I suppose you could say. You know. And out of that, various things have been sorted, like the first, like it's a like a three-step thing, but not lineal. It's all kind of at once, I suppose. So the ordering of society and of a political life of that collective, the ordering of it, and then to me the law, all law, natural, ancient, Western, whatever, is the regulation of that ordering somehow. And then the philosophical part, the underpinning part of it, is the provisioning of meaning about that whole ordering, the provisioning of meaning about it, meaning and purpose, actually. What is it all about? You know, what is it all for? And so on and so on. And for me, it seems to have come down to two things. Developing a relational ethos, a relationalist ethos, out of this reciprocal relationship. And of course, there's a survivalist ethos there too. And don't look at it in Aristotelian logical terms, like the excluded middle idea. You know, everybody's done logic, I suppose, especially in law, right? And it's all based mainly on Aristotelian logic. But the most important part is that the excluded middle part. So you're either right or wrong, or good or bad, or you know, sinful or not sinful, or whatever. And to me, that's the survivalist ethos writ large. And I don't see it as excluded middle. They sit beside each other. It's not either relationalist ethos or survivalist ethos. It's both together, because we are spirit beings. We're human, so we have reflection, and we also have instinct, of course. Animals are spirit beings, but the whole of nature has spiritual essence. So of course rivers do and mountains do, the cosmos does, everything, flora and fauna, insects, you know, and so on. So they all have spirit, but also instinct. But as for reflectivity, you know, it's humans that have that. They reflect on these things and so on and so on. So the idea of developing a regulatory system for this ordered world, and the underpinning of a philosophical kind of idea, has developed. And in a way, it's sort of like, those, what do you call them, bubbles, biosphere bubbles. In a way, it's poor old Australia, you know, it's a bit like that, the whole of it. We had all this time, with a little bit of visiting and interruption, interaction, I should say, across the north with Asian groups. But essentially, it was sort of like an experimental bubble. So it's not any kind of great wisdom or anything like that. We had all this time to work out how to have a positive, stable society. So it started out to be this relational ethos, but with alongside having the survivalist ethos too. So all these different places here on the map, all of them are, there's nothing hierarchical about it. So there's nothing, no dominating tribal system that dominates everybody else in all the land around us. There's no Alexander the Great character, great warrior type, who just invades for the sake of invading. After a while, his own mob gets sick of him and want to go home, you know. So they're all, it's to do with autonomous groups. They're all autonomous. Territorial integrity is absolutely the ruler right across the whole country, because every square inch of the country is somebody's responsibility. So you're not obliged to love your neighbour, but so if you want to have battles or conflicts, or you just don't like each other, you can have conflict, but you cannot invade somebody else's territory. It's a general rule, and it is a law, I do believe. It's a law right across the whole country, and it's still there, especially in our logic. We have our own logic. It's not Aristotelian logic. It's not Chinese logic, although the Chinese logic is a bit closer to us, you know, because they deal with uncertainty, paradoxes, nuances, and so on, whereas I think Western logic, and you see it really clearly, I think, in law. They can't stand uncertainty. They've got to have certainty. It's either got to be this or that, you know. And so Aboriginal people, they agree with the Chinese paradoxical logic, you know. The world is far more complex than that. So you have regulatory systems, law, right across the whole country that goes with that. So territorial integrity, autonomy. Not only that, all the individuals in all these autonomous clan groups, where they're still surviving, actually, they're all autonomous beings too. So all life force, all the, like rivers, mountains, they're all autonomous spiritual entities too. Women are autonomous, of course. So it's not a hierarchy. It's a lateral system, a heterarchy. The actual name of it is, it's flat, lateral, if you like that. And the actual governance political system is where not like Western systems, which conflates power and authority. They put it together. If you have power, then you've got authority to. That gives you the authority because you've got the power, the force behind you, to do whatever you like. In Aboriginal thinking, governance thinking, it's separated. You either have authority or power, and power generally is diffused throughout the whole group. Power is diffused. You cannot be an Alexander the Great or a Pharaoh or a Caesar and tell people what to do on pain of death or anything like that, or a Prime Minister. Mad or otherwise, you know, presidents and so on. So you just simply can't have hierarchies. Power's got to be diffused, and authority, and you could say moral authority, but it's a bit like it's a bit hard to. It's more like there's an old-fashioned Western term to do with gentlemanly forbearance. I don't know if you know forbearance. It's to do with diplomacy, ethical behaviour. I think in the European sense it was a class-ridden thing, but it can be a general thing too. You're behaving properly, really. Mm-hmm. All of those sort of things, forbearance. So you a person, older man or woman, or an exceptional younger person, has to have this presence, this authority, and then they are seen as the people who are like the almost like principal. People who know the laws or who know the rules about looking after the country, about custodial ethic. The custodial ethic says that you have to look after the whole place, and it's a kind of a saying too, looking after country, looking after kin. So that system of a custodial ethic, of relationalist ethos, is aimed at the country. It's a relationship with the country, but it's also the template for the social system, though, too. So you're obliged, we are all obliged, to basically look after the place. By all means have what do you call it, battles and disagreements, but don't invade somebody else's land. Mm. You know, there's a, the Cartesian, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. There's no equivalent, Aboriginal equivalent, but if there was, it'd be, I am located, therefore I am. So place is with a capital P, absolutely with a capital P, and that's why it's territorial integrity. And that life principle, if you like, of individuals and collectives has come into our logic. So the logic is still there, even though colonialism wrecked a whole lot of things, you know, old ways, places, people, of course. But that thinking, that logical thinking like that, is still there. So, and it's taken forever, and I think they still don't understand it, governments have never understood it, that there is no such group as Aboriginal, all the Aboriginal people, all the Aboriginal nation. They're like, somebody once described it like, they're all like, what do you call it? Local governments. It's a whole country, continent, full of local governments. Or, if you like, they're also like, in the religious, spiritual sense, they're like, instead of having one genesis, there's hundreds of them. Hundreds of genesises. All of them. So you're obliged, you see, to look after your place. It's deeper than obligation, as apparently scientists just recently have found. We're so old, apparently, been in the same place for tens of thousands of years, that we're genetically embedded in the country. So the DNA of the country is in us and vice versa. So it's a beyond culture, actually. It's really like beyond culture, you know. But I can never understand that, you know, the Western law thing of why Western law is the way it is, because our, you know, given all of that underpinning, that the land is the source of the law. My cousin Chris Morris has written on this, and I think she coined that phrase. She coined that phrase: the land is the source of the law. So the source of the of our notion of law is totally embedded in land itself, but more to do with land, not just land, but a place in land, and our obligations of every different group wherever you're living, you know, wherever you're living. So everybody here, if you're living on the Gold Coast, you're all obliged to look after the river, the five rivers, the sea, and you know, everything growing, and so on and so on. So it's just very different. There's so many contradictions in Western law. I can't figure it out, because especially in the area of foreign policy, you know, and they talk on the one hand very casually about, well, no, not casually, they talk about it as if it's really important international law. And then I see it being broken everywhere. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Foreign policy, like, marks out, you know, what do you call it? Chucks out international law, just like that, you know, no reasoning, no nothing, you know, just the international politics and international relations beat that, trumps, that's what I wanted to say, but it trumps it. so much for international law, and so much for all the contradictions, for what I see in Western law itself, you know, about the individual and about looking after land and having a stable, fair society, you know, a fair society where there aren't people in who are on the inside and on the outside, and you know, all of that kind of thing, I guess. So yes, it's definitely it's the relationalist ethos and the four, what I call the four main features of this relationalist ethos, is place, of course. Ethics, autonomy, and now this is where you no, actually. geez, sorry, there's a fourth one. It's like they're four pillars of this relationalist ethos, and you, they keep going. They have to keep going. Different peoples have remarked on how Aboriginal people have they literally work very hard at, say, congenial fellowship.
Obligation?
Obligation too. But how getting on is actually hard work, you know. So it's nothing to do with no notion of perfectibility, because you're not going anywhere. In the old traditional system, there's no God. There's no hierarchy at all. So there's no God. There's no place like heaven and hell. It doesn't exist. You know, this is really old, and of course there's thousands of Christians now. So you're not going anywhere, so you have to work out how to get on with each other, but not to the extent of, you know, loving all humanity, because what is that, you know, some people are mongrels, you know, and you like having a good argument and fight with them, you know, and that's it's in our repertoire, it's in our human repertoire, and this is what I really like about our old system. It's more like realpolitik, not ideal politics. It accepts who we are and what we are and what we're capable of. How do you extend relationships, and so on? And you have to literally work at it. So that's why there is still acknowledging other people, welcomes. They're not just manners, you know, mannerly thing. They are actually there to continually. It's like a beat, you know, continually encourage to get on with each other, how to maintain peaceful relations. That's what it's about. It's not making peace, but it maintains peaceful relations. And you have to keep doing it all the time. And of course, things like individualism, especially a cult of individualism, and materialism, And not just vulgar materialism, you know, my car, my house, my money and all that. Philosophical materialism, do you know? All you see is what you get, you know, that's it. You know, spirit doesn't exist and all that kind of stuff. It interrupts good relations, you know. And remember, relations aren't necessarily all the positive things. For example, you have traditional enemies. You can have traditional enemies. You won't always get on with each other, or something mightn't be settled from, you know, centuries before or whatever. So you have an enemy for a long time. And that's a relationalist ethos. That's not a survivalist ethos at all. Because if you're going to have enemies, the best ones to have are traditional enemies, actually. Because psychologically, you know each other very well. You know their weaknesses and their strengths and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you look at England and France, all those battles, over centuries and centuries, and they end up being, to each other, they're the old enemy. The old enemy, aren't they, to each other? You know, so sooner or later, you're going to end up like that. If you can't, you're not going to move out of your place. But of course, natural things make things change. Earthquakes go off, the sea reclaims land or recedes. Earthquakes, volcanoes, I mean, and so on. So people have to go, they disappear, or they have to move. And so all those diplomatic protocols that have been in place for, you know, eons come into play. They come into play. Well, how do you get on with this? And of course, the biggest interruption is colonialism, and we're still working those sorts of things out. And there is a continuous, not a war, I'd say. It's not a battle. It's a contradiction for us. You've heard of Bennelong, and you've heard of Pemulwuy. Pemulwuy is the resistor. Bennelong is the person in our own version of our own diplomatic way, see, how we did these. And somebody very smart at the moment, a very good political analyst, an Aboriginal person, is writing about this, and it'll be really valuable when it comes out. How do we resolve this contradiction for ourselves? See? How do we do this? The resistor and the Aboriginal system, the old Aboriginal system. Because we still insist on our place, because it's so old and it's so embedded in us that it'll always be there. And it comes into modern politics too. People will refuse to listen to the chosen, selected representatives of Aboriginal people, because they don't have authority. All they have is power. And really, in the end, authority is more powerful than power itself, you know. It really is far more powerful. So the ones who have power, or are sitting next to it, they don't have any authority whatsoever in our terms. Not at all. So what all that means, and it is good, really encouraging, that the whole idea of nature and the law, Western law, trying to tackle these sorts of difficult sort of topics, subjects, is very encouraging. It's really encouraging, actually. But it would be wonderful if something a bit more, I don't know how, but complex, or some more exploration into the thing of, well, why only rights? Why not obligations? Strengthening the idea of obligations. Because that's a very good thing for strengthening relationships. Do you know? And the logic, the equation of our logic, is that all perspectives are valid and reasonable. All perspectives are valid and reasonable. Every perspective from every place is valid and reasonable. You can't argue. You can argue, but you can't argue to the point of getting rid of that other view. You've got to learn to live with it, actually, which is very difficult. It takes great skill, and Aboriginal people have had that skill for, you know, a long time, actually. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Eh? Yeah.
Bill,
we might have time for just one quick question, because then I'd really like to give the judge some time. So,
would you mind standing for leader of this country?
No, we don't have leaders on it. No.
Thank you for your talk. I loved it.
Any other questions for Professor Graham? Yeah, Bee Chen.
One quick one, more commentary. I take great part. applications.